I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, why we need foreign news and how we can do it, and why reporting from Mexico is so dangerous for Mexicans.
The old system said, we have a responsibility to give you news that you may not think you care about because we think it's important and good for you.
I don't know who can be listening to me, who can be watching me. It feels like every journalist is walking around with a target in his back.
Try to think in another country where you would have the same amount of journalists murdered.
The real story of Juarez is who runs Juarez. That's a killer story.
I want to make the case that international news makes us more successful, that it makes us richer, that it makes us better problem solvers.
There are mysterious forces out there beyond our comprehension. I speak, of course, of the terrifying phenomenon known as other countries.
That's coming up after this.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. According to the ancient Romans, the dog days of summer end this weekend, August 24th to be exact, a time of year, the ancients said, when the seas boil, wine sours, and men become fevered and frenzied. This past week had the feel of the dog days, what with the radioactive water issuing from Japan's Fukushima nuclear plant, the reported death of hundreds from chemical weapon attacks in Syria, the toll climbing past 1,000 of those killed in clashes between the Egyptian military and supporters of ousted President Morsi. Now, I don't mention America's domestic woes because they're better covered, thus harder to ignore. But Ethan Zuckerman, director of the MIT Center for Civic Media and author of the new book, Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection, says that the shorter shrift we give to the rest of the world brings great risks. In fact, he'd like to do away with the very term foreign news.
Foreign news sort of implies that it doesn't affect us in the United States. All we really need to pay attention to is what happens in our community and occasionally what happens in an election. And of course, that's farcical.
In fact, Stephen Colbert has made a whole deal of this.
You know, there are mysterious forces out there, forces beyond our comprehension, that have a strange influence on all of us. I speak, of course, of the terrifying phenomenon known as other countries. This is un-American news.
What do you think the state of play is with regard to international news coverage?
Great academic study recently done looking at international news coverage in the U.S. on NBC News and on the New York Times from 1950 to 2006. The number of countries has shrunk. The number of total stories has shrunk. Alisa Miller, when she was the head of Public Radio International, did a great TED Talk where she looked at international news coverage in broadcast media in the U.S., saw it shrinking from about 35% of the news whole in the 1970s during the Vietnam War down to less than 15% these days.
So why don't we hear more about the world? One reason is that news networks have reduced the number of their foreign bureaus by half. Aside from one person, ABC mini bureaus in Nairobi, New Delhi, and Mumbai, there are no network news bureaus in all of Africa, India, or South America. And this lack of global coverage is all the more disturbing when we see where people go for news. Local TV news looms large, and unfortunately only dedicates 12% of its coverage to international news. And what about the web? The most popular news sites don't do much better. Last year, Pew and the Columbia J School analyzed the 14,000 stories that appeared on Google News' front page, and they in fact covered the same 24 news events. Similarly, a study in e-content showed that much of global news from U.S. news creators is recycled stories from the AP wire services and Reuters, and don't put things into a context that people can understand their connection to it. So, this could help explain why today's college graduates, as well as less educated Americans, know less about the world than their counterparts did 20 years ago.
There was a study, I think it came out of Harvard, and it determined that in this age of infinite information sources, people who are naturally curious are better informed than they were prior to the existence of those sources, and people who are not curious are less informed. So once again, it seems to boil down to human nature. The more choice we have presented to us, the more we choose parochially. Is there a cure for that?
I think your formulation is exactly right. And I talk a lot about three forms of discovery. There's an old form of discovery where we read a newspaper, we listen to a news broadcast, and we're led by the editor. Whatever gets put in front of us, we're going to consume or not consume. And we know that there are biases to that, but at least it tends to push us towards variety. Then we move to search engines. And search engines are a wonderful tool for the curious. You find anything that you're interested in, anything that you're excited by, but there's no guarantee that what you're interested in is going to expand over time. There's no guarantee that it's going to pull you away from local concerns. We are all hardwired to pay attention to the people who are most like us. It's a sociological tendency called homophily. It's one of the strongest and best documented social forces. We have a very strong tendency to pay attention to the people who are already close to us.
This is not merely an academic issue for you. Back in 2004, you created Global Voices, a way to offer translated material from citizen media all across the world. You were disappointed.
My ambition was we would be able to hand NPR and the New York Times and all these other wonderful journalistic organizations so many stories from the developing world that we would see a meaningful shift in coverage. And so we're now more than 8 years into the project. We've got 1,100 people who work on putting the site together. We put out editions in 30 languages. But at the end of the day, we have a much smaller reach than we would have thought. A lot of the people who pay attention to Global Voices want to know information from the country that they came from or the country that they study. What we've gotten right is we've gotten very good at translating it in trying to make international news understandable to U.S. audiences. What we have not done at all is tried to figure out how to say to a U.S. audience, you really need to know about this, even if you don't think you need to know about this.
In trying to find a solution, you've become a big proponent of sites like OK Africa, which introduces African hip-hop to American audiences. Vice is a site for Western hipsters, which has been reporting features from the Congo and North Korea. Is this the kind of news that you're talking about?
Well, so that's a great pairing, right? OK Africa is a project from The Roots, the legendary hip-hop crew, and it's a terrific way for people who are hip-hop fans but don't actually know very much about Africa to get introduced to what's going on in an incredibly diverse musical culture, and in some cases actually get tied into the politics. So you find yourself reading on OK Africa about Senegalese hip-hop, and you very quickly find yourself reading about a group called Yanamar, which is an activist group made out of Senegalese journalists and rap stars who managed to mobilize 600,000 youth voters and ousted Abdoulaye Wade and brought in Macky Sall, and before you know it, you're sort of nose deep in West African politics. It's also possible to get it wrong. And, you know, in my experience, Vice, at least on Africa, probably gets it wrong more than they get it right. A Vice PR person asked me to look at a video that they'd done on rampant alcoholism in Uganda, the drunkest nation on the planet. You know, it is the second highest alcohol consumption in sub-Saharan Africa. It doesn't compare to Europe. It's not even in the same league. So basically, it's the drunkest black people. And so if you actually want a representation of what contemporary Uganda, a country that I know pretty well, is like, it falls pretty short. So there's definitely something to be said about building programming that's compelling, that plays on people's existing interests in movies, in music, in food, in culture, in fashion. But there's also a question of who gets to speak. And are you showcasing people on the ground, or are you basically laughing at difference? But I think what both OK Africa and Vice do is demonstrate that there is potentially an audience for international news and culture. The question is, how do we get people in the door?
How important do you think the old model was or is? You know, reporters who actually live in the place, those who parachute in, reflect the values and see through the lens of their parent organization. So, good riddance.
Here's the piece that I want to keep from the old system. The old system said, we have a responsibility to give you news that you may not think you care about because we think it's important and good for you. I am okay with losing the veteran foreign correspondent if we get very, very good at identifying great talent on the ground who can bridge that gap for us. And what I'm optimistic about is that I'm meeting incredibly smart, savvy writers, many of whom are purely writing online at this point, who could open the door with some coaching, with some help, with some editing. I think we could have another golden age of international news, but we'd have to want it and we'd have to choose to build it.
If you could just convince people that it would make them thinner, you'd have a much better chance.
I think some of it's about human connection. Our Middle East editor is an amazing Bahraini woman named Amira Al-Husani. There are a lot of people who read Global Voices who feel like they know Amira and who have started following Bahrain passionately because of having that relationship with her as a writer and her as a correspondent. And as we start caring about those people, maybe we start caring about some of those stories. I've had a wonderful ongoing conversation with Cameron Marlowe, who's the in-house sociologist at Facebook. And his argument is, yep, see this problem? We're going to fix it. So don't worry about it. Because what's going to happen soon is you'll have a Bahraini within 2 degrees of your circle on Facebook, and because a friend of a friend cares about Bahrain, you're going to care about Bahrain. And therefore, the New York Times doesn't need to cover it. I'm not convinced I care about what my friends of friends think. I think people are one way we get there. I want to make the case that international news makes us more successful, that it makes us richer, that it makes us better problem solvers. If we can make the case that one of the things we have to protect, as well as our ability to do investigative journalism, as well as our ability to do great statehouse work, one of the things we have to protect is the ability to feature really important stories from around the world.
Ethan, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Brooke. This is always such a pleasure.
Ethan Zuckerman is author of Rewire, Digital Cosmopolitans in the Age of Connection. Around the world? How about just south of our border? Last year, reporter Marianne McCune and I went to Mexico to discover some of what we don't know about our southern neighbor and to correct what we thought we did know. The new newspaper in Veracruz. Are you crazy?
Yes. Are you crazy? I'm crazy.
Up next, some of the highlights from that show. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Last fall, reporter Marianne McCune and I went to Mexico to learn about the roadblocks to effective reporting on that nation's most persistent problems, ones that inevitably slip north, that are our problems too, that we've had a hand in creating, like the drug war. For some background, Marianne and I met with Mike O'Connor, the Committee to Protect Journalists' man in Mexico City at a local eatery, and he gave us a briefing on then-President Felipe Calderón's drug war, launched in 2006, a war that compounded the murder and mayhem normally associated with drug trafficking, with a death toll topping 50,000.
What happened is that Mexicans were now getting hooked on drugs. Organized crime cartels were turning inward and controlling almost all illicit activities in growing areas of the country. and challenging the federal government over who controlled growing parts of Mexico. He looked around and said, wow, what can I do? The cops are corrupt, inept, or scared to death. I'll call the army, and the army will do something. But the army is the army. The army knocks down buildings and wipes out masses of opposing forces. The army doesn't arrest criminals, and they don't know how to do criminal work. You know, you could take the smartest colonel in the Mexican army and put him in charge of one-third of the city of Juarez and say, okay, it's up to you. You've got 500 men, and you got it. And someone steals a bicycle. Now, what's the smartest colonel in the Mexican army going to do about that stolen bicycle?
Nothing. Ignore it.
Ignore it. All right, now someone rapes somebody. Now someone kills 15 people there. What is he going to do? Nothing.
Why nothing?
Because he doesn't know what to do. He's a colonel in the army.
Why has the pressure diminished a little bit in Juarez? Why is the crime rate down?
A very reasonable, plausible reason is that one side of the groups in conflict has won, and the war is pretty much over, and so the killing is down.
What about the state of journalism in Juarez?
The real story in Juarez is who runs Juarez. Most news organizations in Juarez will not get close to that story. That's a killer story. Is it a compromise? Or you know, it's what do you do if you're sitting at a stoplight and a guy puts a gun barrel to your head and says, get out of your car, I'm taking it. Have you made a compromise with that guy? Yeah, you have. But are you less of a person for having done that?
And how often do you think that the murders of journalists are a result of those journalists making a deal with one side or another?
I don't know how many. And you know why? Because no one ever investigates the crimes. And what we're left with is a bunch of gossip and a bunch of guessing. You know?
Okay, thank you so much. I'm off to Juarez now. Is there anything I shouldn't ask the mayor there?
When you see the mayor, make it the last day. And make sure your cab to the airport is outside and still running.
It's scheduled for the first day because that's when they were willing to schedule it.
Leave on the first day.
Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Hope to see you again.
Mike O'Connor of the Committee to Protect Journalists. We spoke to him in Mexico City, but now Marianne's cruising down the byways of Juarez.
2 years ago, Ciudad Juarez was known as the murder capital of the world. Drive down the street with a reporter here, and every few blocks, he'll point to where someone was killed, or beheaded, or dismembered, or hung from a bridge. But all along, reporters have found ways to cover at least part of the story. And that's partly because the drug cartels that were warring here are not as violent as the Zetas, the group now terrorizing Veracruz and Tamaulipas. And because this is a town that thrives on news. Thousands of newspapers are printed here every day, from the popular El PM, featuring gory photos of murder victims, plus a page or two of traditional porn, to newspapers with serious investigative units. There's broadcast and internet stations, and most fascinating, sites like El Blog del Narco, which consists partly of accounts of violence posted and read by rival gang members themselves. Whoever made this video snagged photos of the dead from Juarez news sites and used them to celebrate their accomplishments, which may or may not be true.
In Juarez, you cannot report the whole truth because no one has it and because it's too dangerous.
That's Jorge Luis, publisher of the blog La Polaca. Back in 2008, he was among several journalists to receive a slew of serious threats. And when one of them was murdered, Luis fled. Now he publishes from El Paso, Texas. And despite his claim you can't report the truth in Juarez, he was outraged when the city's biggest newspaper, El Diario de Juarez, aimed this headline at the drug cartels. What is it that you want from us?
It is like a police officer saying to a criminal, hey, what do you want me to do? Shall I go over there or over here? It was an embarrassment, and it was applauded around the world.
The world applauded because the paper was printing the truth. It could not cover the news in a city where cartels had more power than the government.
For me, it was more a way to say, listen, people, you don't count anymore.
El Diario reporter Sandra Rodriguez.
Because you are unable to stop this. So we are talking now to the people that is really controlling their life in Juarez.
Rodriguez says after her colleague at the paper was killed,
we're more angry than scared. Killing of Armando produced the opposite reaction of silence.
As a reporter with roots in the States, she says she felt more motivated than ever.
I didn't want any foreign reporter to tell me the story of my city.
El Diario did make compromises. The paper sometimes withheld names or waited to publish risky stories. But Rodriguez has since used transparency laws and shoe leather to cover things like how many murder victims were armed when they were killed.
It was like 2%, like nobody.
Today, she heads downtown to ask some questions at a bakery. Its name has come up in a database she's created to track about 100 young women who've disappeared since 2008. This is a new chapter in an old story in Juarez.
I love this place.
So far, Rodriguez only has data from 10 cases, but her interviews with families are already turning up patterns police seem to have missed.
They tell you like, oh, she was going downtown, she was going downtown, she was going downtown. In this bakery, in this shoes store, etc.
Her reporting put her on the same lonely bus the missing girls took downtown. Now she'll check out the bakery where some applied for jobs. A sign on the door solicits active and presentable 18 to 22-year-olds. Rodriguez says sometimes she'll picture her body lying dead in the places she visits.
As reporters, we all in Juarez, we have talked like, how would you like your funeral?
A few blocks away, a 25-year-old reporter named Luis Chaparro watches a girl do somersaults in a bare-bones boxing gym. She's training for the masked, choreographed fights Mexicans call lucha libre.
What I'm trying to do is know why she decided to do lucha libre in a place where there's a lot of prostitution. And most of the women here are working in bars, are bartenders, or are as prostitutes.
The tattoo on Chaparro's arm is from a book called 80 Worlds in a Day. He says it reminds him to look for the unexpected.
In these ugly corners in Ciudad Juarez where there are people really devastated by life, you can see a lot of joy in their eyes, and that's what my tattoo reminds me of.
But Chaparro covers much more than lifestyle. Last year, he says he too was threatened after publishing names of corrupt police. He found himself on the floor, hands and feet tied, with a gun pressed to his head.
That's when the situation here at this border is ugly, you know, when you blame the authorities.
So do you avoid doing that?
Yes, I avoid to directly accuse the authorities.
Last week, he reported a local gang is teaming up with the Zetas, the sadists terrorizing other states. Chaparro's source was a gang leader.
I think there's ways to get close to dangerous people. If you always talk with the truth, I prefer to be in the streets and to go out with a drug dealer who I can trust. Or
the phrase, a drug dealer I can trust, is interesting given the context.
Yeah. Yes, it's kind of weird.
In the old days, reporters say drug cartels sometimes handed them cash, saying, please refrain from talking about us. Government officials, too. Now, at least in Juarez, they say bribes have been replaced by threats. But money still plays an editorial role. Most media outlets depend on income from government-placed ads.
Are there limits to what you're allowed to say in your paper?
Well, unfortunately, I think that the money that the government spends in media provokes censorship.
Sandra Rodriguez is both driven to succeed and pessimistic about her chances, given Mexico's flawed media policy and what seems to her just a temporary lull in the violence in Juarez.
All the elements that fuel the violence, the poverty, the impunity, the corruption, I mean, the elements are still there. We haven't solved any of the problems that were fueling our violence.
As you heard a few minutes ago, a few days earlier back in Mexico City, we got a quick briefing from the Committee to Protect Journalists, Mike O'Connor. After Marianne left to catch her flight to Juarez, I asked him about Veracruz.
If you're a journalist in Veracruz, and you're approached by a criminal and told, you have to work for me, the last thing you think of doing is going to the police department because you know the police department works for the criminals. And you're not going to go to the district attorney because the district attorney works for the criminals.
You covered the Balkans.
For years. I liked that story.
Not safe.
But that was combat. Or that was Sarajevo, where there was, you know, a lot of lead in the air and a lot of people were getting killed. This is different. You know, if you get killed in Veracruz, you'll be killed because you're a journalist. They'll go looking for you because of who you are.
On the day I flew into the state of Veracruz, another reporter was murdered. Victor Manuel Baez Chino worked the crime beat for the Daily Milenio in the state capital, Jalapa. A message from the SETAs found near his body read, "This is what happens to those who betray us and try to be clever." Veracruz is now the most dangerous place in Mexico to do journalism. 9 killed in 12 months, many by the SETAs, deemed the most sadistic of the cartels. Roughly 60 miles from Jalapa sits the port of Veracruz, with a lovely central square lined with cafes and a band that gamely plays to mostly empty chairs. A few blocks away, the Parroquia, a cavernous coffee house where journalists cluster with their cameras, rising wearily to photograph a steady stream of candidates in these final days of a contentious election season. A woman in a white coat wanders through with a blood pressure cuff. It's a great location to sell a stress test. Reporters are prime targets. A recent kill list of journalists was rumored to have come not from the cartels, but from the prosecutor's office. Rumors are rampant. The only certainty is that reporters can expect no protection. This 23-year-old newspaper reporter who writes lifestyle pieces is terrified.
Pues principalmente porque...
Mainly because I don't know who can be listening to me, who can be watching me. It feels like every journalist is walking around with a target in his back. It makes me angry that, for instance, the state refused protection to some of my colleagues because they allegedly were implicated with the cartels or something like that.
Que no los van a proteger, ¿no? Porque tienen nexos o algo así. Y se me hace una tontería porque no saben.
That is nonsense. They don't know the circumstances in which these deals or agreements take place. Some colleagues have to do it, because if they don't do them, what will they do? Will they leave town? Where will they go?
Elia Baltazar is co-founder of Journalists on Foot, a woman-centered nonprofit that provides support and training to journalists.
Imagínate en cualquier otro lugar del mundo y muchos periodistas.
Try to think in another country where you would have the same amount of journalists murdered in such a short period of time. I mean, our colleagues who were murdered in Veracruz 3 weeks ago. These three people, they peeled their faces off. What kind of democratic country is that?
Tenemos que preocuparnos por el silencio.
The country is being silenced.
Tamaulipas
is in silence.
Veracruz está siendo silenciado.
Veracruz is in the process of being silenced.
Michoacán, Guerrero. The silence is spreading.
But Veracruz is not entirely mum. There's a new paper in town.
Como Luz María Rivera.
My name is Luz María Rivera. I am the correspondent of La Jornada Mexico Daily in Veracruz. I am also the director of a new weekly that has recently been created, the Mercury of Veracruz.
The new newspaper in Veracruz. Are you crazy?
Yes. I'm crazy.
The front page of your first issue has two articles devoted to violence against journalists. It doesn't seem as if you're shying away from covering the violence in Veracruz.
It is a contradiction. Sometimes I say I want to. I don't know how to call it. I will not keep a distance. Otherwise, I would have already left. When they killed Regina, we all got very scared, especially the women. Women journalists share a similar life. We are alone, not children. Our families live nearby, but when you get home, we are alone. It is a very peculiar situation, and there is no manual for it.
This is a beautiful place where, by all accounts, the institutions are entirely inoperative. If you get the story out, it's likely to make no difference. Do you feel like you're just putting a message in a bottle and throwing it out into the bay?
Sí, por supuesto.
Of course.
Claro.
Clearly.
Yo creo que ese es el ejercicio.
That's the everyday effort of journalism here.
Periodismo aquí, con la ventaja de que nosotros tenemos.
With the advantage that we have the sea. Our colleagues in the north don't have it. They will have to go to the desert. Of course, it is throwing messages in bottles into the sea and thinking that maybe nobody is picking them up. But one day, someone will find them.
We step out onto her tiny balcony and face the sea.
I feel too much love. I love Veracruz. I love my people, my country, my state, and this city is beautiful.
Luz bravely blows a kiss to the port she seems literally willing to die for.
Soy loca. Soy loca por ti. Soy loca. Soy loca por ti.
Coming up, America's Mexico, or the dark legacy of the Frito Bandito.
This is On the Media.
Sentía soledad, ni tenía ilusión de que el amor llegase tanto así.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org.
This is On the Media. I'm Marianne McCune.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with one last tale of a reporter who stuck it to the mob by slipping some real journalism under the entree. Alejandra, not her real name, was a newspaper reporter and radio news anchor in the Cetus stronghold of Tamaulipas, until the Cetus threatened her son. Forced to quit 18 months ago, she began to publish the news on placemats every day, upholding the highest journalistic standards under the plates of myriad restaurant patrons. She even resisted the Pri's offer to buy ad space if she refrained from reporting on López Obrador.
I did not agree. It is more important to keep my freedom and protect the right of people to be informed than to lower myself for the money.
But eventually, she ran afoul of the Cetus again.
One day, I was coming back from being out of town with my daughters and son. And I see that my car that had been parked for days outside of my house was covered in dust. My city is very dusty. In the dust, they had written, "If you keep bothering us, if you carry on, we are coming to rape and kill you and your daughters."
She packed up her daughters and fled, leaving her older son to carry on publishing the placemats. One day, she says, she wants to write a book about all the murdered journalists. But when she does, she'll have to leave the country, partly because her research suggests that most of them were compromised by the cartels.
And partly because
voy a decir directamente lo que
I will be explicit about a government that provides no support, a government overwhelmed by the drug trade, and whether we're citizens, merchants, or journalists, we all have the same fate. A non-functional government, so-called rights organizations that only look for international funding, and at the end, journalists who are all alone.
Reporteros solos.
She teared up a little during our interview. She says she never does that, but it was Friday, and though Tamaulipas is a hive of maniacs and misery, Friday was a time reserved for her friends. She misses them terribly, and she doesn't know when or if she can ever go home. The rest of this program is devoted to perception, by which I mean perceptions of Mexico by Americans. Yes, this is a very self-centered segment. And let's face it, Mexican tourism and American tourists are both handicapped by perceptions. So let's start with the last place you'd probably ever want to visit, where Marianne is.
Ciudad Juárez. It's where burritos were invented. At least that's what they say. And margaritas, too, right here in this downtown bar.
Please come. Take a burrito. See the restaurants. See the streets.
This is the image Mayor Hector Murguia wants to project of Ciudad Juárez.
Yesterday, we did have 200,000 people in just one park. The streets completely full of cars. The restaurants completely full.
The corrupt police force, Murguia says he's replaced one-third of the officers. A former police director convicted of drug smuggling in the U.S., that's history. He says murders are way down here because of the tactics of his new police chief and his new social programs. And here's how he responds to the U.S. Justice Department suggesting the violence is down because the Sinaloa drug cartel won the war.
I really doubt it. I'm not an expert. I'm just a presidente municipal, but...
Well, on that topic, one of the images that people have is not only that there is this problem of cartels and the violence that they cause, but there is a problem of public officials being linked with cartels.
Not linked.
How can you prove?
Not linked. I don't have to prove nothing. If there is a public official who is linked with drugs, sooner or later it's going to be dead. And the proof is that we're still alive.
Across the border is El Paso, Texas, billing itself as the safest big city in the United States. The mayor here is known for his plain talk and his guitars.
Well, El Paso's your land, El Paso's my land.
These two cities' economies are inextricably linked. Mayor John Cook says El Paso benefits hugely from the maquiladoras, the factories across the border.
A lot of their top management lives in El Paso, so they buy their houses here, they buy their cars here, they send their kids to school here.
And they pay taxes here.
And they pay taxes here, right? Well, hopefully.
The two mayors make presentations together to convince businesses this is a good place. Cook says he'll offer tips on how to hold on to your ride.
But if you drive a beat-up old clunker, it's not necessarily the vehicle that they want.
Or a lesson from his military spy training.
You don't always take the same route to work or to home.
Very reassuring. The thing is, when the violence got bad in Juarez, Mayor Cook says he couldn't, in good conscience, encourage everyday people to go.
Not only did we stop at encouraging them to go, we started encouraging them not to go. You know, that's like telling people it's safe to drive without your seatbelt or ride your motorcycle without a helmet.
When the violence was reaching its peak, El Paso's Tourism Convention Bureau decided to redo its colorfully illustrated tourist map of El Paso and Juarez together.
They said, we'll sponsor one, but if you delete Juarez, we don't want to send tourists to Juarez.
Jose Alejandro Lozano has been designing these maps out of his home since 1978, highlighting landmarks on both sides of the border for various clients. For the 2010 map, he says he reluctantly agreed to remove Juarez.
For 4 days straight, they put headline news. Ciudad Juarez has disappeared from the map.
On the new map, he colorfully illustrated the streets of El Paso and, below the border, just dry brown desert where Juarez was supposed to be.
We have the same blood. We have the same relatives. And it's like one of your kids or one of your members in your body has a problem. You can't just cut it off. You want to fix it. You want to take care of it.
During the last 6 years, Demetrio Sotomayor says tourism in Juarez dropped by about 60%. Now it's coming up again, but as director of tourism for the state, he has a lot to surmount. So when Lozano called him up this year to suggest they make yet another El Paso tourist map, this time including Juarez, Sotomayor said, let's do it.
We feel that they're endorsing to come to Juarez, and we're very happy for that. We're thankful and happy that they allowed us to be back in their map.
But Sotomayor may be excessively grateful. El Paso's Tourism Convention Bureau wasn't interested.
They said, no, we don't want to sponsor it.
Instead, it's the state of Chihuahua that's giving seed money. So this time around, it's Juarez promoting its link to El Paso. The effort to push a new image of Juarez extends well beyond public officials. There's a growing movement of colectivos, groups of young people putting their own mark on the city.
Okay, ¿cómo te llamas?
Me llamo Daisy Acevedo García.
Like the mural these kids are painting on the wall of a well-trafficked underpass.
Algunos dicen que aquí los de Juárez son malos.
Daisy says some people think people from Juárez are bad. This is her way of saying no. Somewhere on the internet, you can find a photo of this bridge with a body hanging off it and a note scrawled by some member of a drug gang. Now, young faces in gray and white paint are populating its walls. At a working-class home on a Friday night, Susana Molina, a.k.a. the Black Sheep, appears on a friend's internet radio show, Voices of the Underground. She's also part of the collective movement, but rap is her mode of expression.
Bueno, en lo personal, para mí es importante registrarme, ¿no?
She says for her, it's important just to register her voice here as a strong young woman with a lot to say in a city better known for girls who disappear.
Mexico has gorgeous beaches, archaeological sites, great food, and everything a traveler could wish. So promoting it should be easy, right? Recent global media has driven our perception to an all-time low.
Should defer travel to 4 entire states and parts of 10 others.
Selling Mexico to skittish Americans will take more than putting parts of it back on a map.
So we had to redefine ourselves. We decided to keep our mouths shut and let the most important people do the talking for us, our visitors.
This is a promotional video produced by Publicis Mexico, a PR firm touting its Mexico Taxi project, a series of testimonials by real-life American tourists fresh off their planes from their Mexican vacations, talking to American cab drivers on American soil.
Where are you guys coming in from?
Cabo.
Oh. Do you guys feel, like, safe and everything down there?
That was one of our biggest meals.
Totally safe.
Right.
Yeah.
The great thing about Cabo is everything's so easy, everyone's so friendly.
2011 apparently was a record year for Mexican tourism. Yet attracting Americans still is a challenge, what with U.S. State Department warnings and whatnot.
The biggest change in the approach was not ask people here in Mexico, because you don't want to tell the truth to somebody if you're in his house.
Alfredo Alcuzira is Publicis Mexico's creative director.
If the house smells or isn't pretty or anything, you're not going to say it. It's rude to somebody to say, your house is not pretty, I'm not having a good time, to your face in your house. So we went to U.S. major airports to do interviews there. And the interviews were conducted by an actor who was posing as a cab driver.
Mexico's National Tourism Board offers plausible portraits of pleasing destinations, Los Cabos, Puerto Vallarta, Cancun. As we know, Juarez has some problems attracting tourists, but has its problems cast a shadow on places like Cancun?
Has there ever been a product or a place or anything that you have found as challenging as this?
Selling American cars on 2008. I don't want to say the brand, but...
It was a bitch.
Yeah.
Why was it hard?
Because that was the year when the two big American brands went bankrupt, and also that side of the border, media was taking a party with them. Every day it was, oh, bad quality, bad cars, bad numbers, they're going to disappear.
Can I ask how you did it?
Now that I think about it, it was kind of a similar approach. The problem with the car and the brand was about perception, not about the car itself. So once we got the people inside the car, they were the ones who started talking good about it.
I'm assuming you don't want to say what car that was.
It was the Ford Focus.
Why does it seem less politically correct to diss a Ford than a nation? Because it seems like it is. Listen to this astonishing episode of the BBC show Top Gear about cars. This one about a Mexican sports car.
Cars reflect national characteristics, don't they? So German cars are sort of very well built and efficient. Yeah. Italian cars are a bit flamboyant and quick. Mexican cars just going to be a lazy, feckless, flatulent leaning against a fence asleep, looking at a cactus with a blanket with a hole in the middle on as a coat.
After saucily likening Mexican cuisine to vomit, they end on a flourish.
I'm sorry, but just imagine waking up and remembering you're Mexican.
That'd be brilliant. It'd be brilliant because you could just go straight back to sleep again. That's why we're not going to get any complaints about this, because the Mexican embassy, the ambassador's going to be sitting there with a remote control like this. They won't complain. It's fine.
Actually, he did. The BBC apologized. But such capering, carefree bigotry doesn't come from nowhere.
Even the fact that people have the idea to make that kind of a joke comes from information that they've received previously.
Jim Johnston, a Mexican citizen born in the U.S., blogs about Mexico City.
Because these guys probably have never been to Mexico. And yet there are still these image ideas that creep up and show up in jokes, in cartoons, in songs, and things like that. There have been a lot of cartoon images of Mexicans as thieves or as stupid laborers.
Ay, 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 ay. Oh, I am the Frito Bandito. Give me Fritos con chips and I'll be your friend. The Frito Bandito, you must not offend.
It's a bit late for that.
A couple of years ago, there was an article in the New York Times.
Mexican blogger Jim Johnston.
It was a story about Mexico City, about a store that sells bulletproof clothing. And there was one sentence in it that said, I'm paraphrasing, if you walk up to somebody in Mexico City these days, if you go up and ask for directions, they're as likely to run away from you as they are to give you an answer. And it just didn't make any sense to me. It gave you this feeling that being on the streets of Mexico City, everyone was petrified. If you walked up to a stranger and asked them a question, they were going to run away from you. And I thought, this is just ridiculous. This is not at all true. And it would have gone into their brains in this sort of very subliminal, poisonous way and given people, I think, completely wrong idea of Mexico City. I mean, if that even happened once to the author of that article, I would have been surprised.
I think the relation among American and Mexicans is not deep.
Ricardo Garcia is the editor of Gente, a glossy magazine of style, culture, and politics.
Maybe because Americans just don't have time, or don't have the interest, or don't try.
And how does it make you feel?
Bad, because if you have a neighbor that is very, how do you say?
When snobbish?
Snobbish. Snobbish and rich, and he doesn't say hello in the morning. How will you feel? You are sick. Your house is not very well, you know, has a lot of problems, and you live in the same neighborhood. And the people in front of you don't even say hello. How would you feel that about? It's painful, yes. And on the other hand, you have a lot of anger. Why doesn't he feel something for this? He lives here, you know?
Okay, so a funny thing happened to me the first day in Mexico City. We were walking down the street in advance of the demonstration. I was carrying my recording kit, and I saw a man with a hurdy-gurdy. So I pulled out the mic. Excuse the terrible mic noise, I wasn't wearing headphones and I hadn't set a level, and he starts playing this.
Not that song.
And I moan, oh no, not that. And our fixer, a Mexican scholar, journalist, and social media maven who helped plan our interview, said, what's the matter? That's a beautiful Mexican folk song, Cielito Lindo. But all I heard was the Frito Bandito. And I felt bad. I looked it up. It's a ranchero song, almost 150 years old, embraced and adapted in every region, and I Fritoed it. So then I started playing versions of it on iTunes, and now I really like it. We were lucky to have chosen this week to be in Mexico because so much was visible that is often obscured. It's a warm and gracious culture, but also formal and restrained, at least compared to Brooklyn. This week, however, much that is customarily left unsaid was ringing from the rafters. Mexico's media culture is giddy with connection fever, which is sparking across generations and political parties for the first time during a national election. The structure of media is being analyzed and criticized from every corner, and that's a self-reflective exercise on a national scale. Meanwhile, the fortresses of silence enclosing the states that are racked and wrecked by the cartels are eroding. It's happening at a terrible cost, but it's happening. Voices are being heard, if not yet heeded. That's it for this week's show, much of which was first aired last summer. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary, and it was edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Andrew Dunn. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.